Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West. From the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Riddell, reading Crossing the Plains, Days of 57, by William Audley Maxwell. Chapter 3. Lost in the Black Hills. At Fort Laramie, we left the Platte River, and bearing northwesterly entered the Black Hills, a region of low, rolling uplands, sparsely grown with scrubby pine trees, the soil black, very dry, where little animal life was visible excepting prairie dogs. There may be readers who, at the mention of prairie dogs, see mentally a wolf or other specimen of the genus Canis, of ordinary kind and size. The prairie dog, however, is not of the dog species. It bears some resemblance to a squirrel and a rat, but is larger than either. It may be likened to the canine only in that it barks, somewhat as do small dogs. Prairie dogs live in holes, dug by themselves. 20 to 50 of these holes may be seen within a radius of a few yards, and such communities are known to plains people as towns. On the approach of anything they fear, the little fellows sit erect, look defiant, and chatter saucily. If the intruder comes too near, the commanding individual of the group, the mayor of the town, so to speak, gives an alarm, plainly interpreted as, "Beware, make safe, each man for himself." And instantly, each one turns an exquisite somersault and disappears as he drops head downward into the hole beside him. John L. Maxwell had made the trip over the plains, from the Missouri River to California in 1854, returning via Panama in 1856, to take his family to the West, accompanying the train of his elder brother, Dr. Kennedy Maxwell. He was of great service to us now, by reason of his experience and consequent knowledge of the country traversed. He was, therefore, elected to act as pilot of the company with the title Captain John, which clung to him for many years. The emigrant trail in some parts of the way was well marked. In other places there was none, and we had to find our way as best we could, not always without difficulty. Often Captain John and others would ride ahead of the train a considerable distance, select routes for passage through the places where travel was hard or risky, choose campsites, and returning, pilot the train accordingly. At various times, despite every care in selecting the route, the train went on a wrong course, and at least once was completely astray. This was one morning as the company was passing out of the Black Hills country. Information that had been received that at this place a shortcut could be made, which would save 15 or 20 miles. There were no marks on the ground indicating that any train ahead had gone that way, but the leaders decided to try it. This venture led the company into a situation not unlike the proverbial jumping-off place. Directly in our course was a declivity, which dropped an estimated depth of 60 to 100 feet below the narrow, stony flat on which we stood, down into a depressed valley. Abrupt ridges of broken stone formation were on our right and left, enclosing us in a small space of barren waste earth. The elements had crumbled the rocks down for ages, until what perhaps had once been a deep canyon was now a narrow flat, a mass of debris, terminating at the top of the steep, ragged cliff that pitched downward before us. The high, rocky ridges on both sides were wholly impassable, at least for the teams. A search finally disclosed at the base of the ridge on our right a single possible passage. It was narrow, slightly wider than a wagon, and led downward at a steep incline into the valley below, where the rocks protruding from both its side walls, its bottom strewn with stones, such as our vehicles could not pass over, in an ordinary way. We were confronted with the problem, how to get the wagons down that yawning fissure, the alternative being to retrace our steps many miles. At the bottom of this cliff or wall that barred our way could be seen a beautiful valley stretching far and wide away to the northwest, a scene of enchanting loveliness, a refreshing contrast to the dry and nearly barren hills over which we had traveled during the many days last past. A short distance from the foot of the wall was a small stream of clear water running over the meadow flat. Rich pasture extended along the line of trees that marked the serpentine course of the brook, which zigzagged its way toward the southwest. Every man, woman, and child of our company expressed in some way the declaration, "We must get into that beautiful oasis." It looked like field, park, and orchard in one landscape, all fenced off from the desolate surroundings by this wall of stone. Like Moses viewing Canaan from Nebo's top, we looked down and yearned to be amidst its freshness. It was not decreed that we should not enter in. A little distance to the south, near the other ridge, we discovered another opening, through which the animals could be driven down, but through which the wagons could not pass. This was a narrow, crooked ravine and very steep, running diagonally down through the cliff, a sort of dry waterway, entirely bridged over in one part by an arch of stone, making it there a natural tunnel or open-ended cave, terminating at the base of the cliff in an immense doorway opening into the valley. The teams were unhitched from the wagons, the yokes taken off the oxen, and all the cattle, horses, and mules were driven through the incline tunnel into the coveted valley. The women and children clambered down, taking with them what they could of the camp things for immediate use, and soon were quite at home in the valley, making free use of the little creek for whatever purposes. A little creek of pure, cold, fresh water is good for a lot of thirsty, dust-covered wayfarers. The puzzle of getting the wagons down next engrossed the attention of our best engineers. The proposition to unpack the lading, take the wagons apart, and carry all down by hand appeared for a time to be the only feasible plan. Captain John, however, suggested procuring rope or chain about 100 feet in length for use in lowering the wagons one at a time through the first mentioned passage. Sufficient rope was brought, one end fastened to the rear axle of a wagon, the other end turned around a dwarf pine at the top of the bluff. Two men managed the rope, preventing too rapid descent at the steeper places, while others guided the wheels over the stones, and the wagon was lowered through the crevice with little damage. Thus, one by one, all the wagons were taken into the valley before the sun set. It was a happy camp we had that night, though every man was tired. There was wood for fire and a supply of good water and pasture sufficient for dozens of camps. Someone ventured the opinion that the Mormon pioneers had overlooked that spot when seeking a new location for Zion. Except that it was very pleasant to inhabit, we knew little of the place we had ventured into or its location. How we were to get out did not appear. Nor for the time being did this greatly concern us, and soon after supper the camp was wrapped in slumber, undisturbed by any coyote duet or, on this occasion, even the twitter of a night bird. We did not hurry the next morning, the inclination being to linger a while in the shady grove by the brookside. With a late start, the day's travel took us some 12 miles, through and out of the valley, to a point where we made the best of a poor camping place on a rough, rocky hillside. The following day there was no road to follow, nor even a buffalo trail or bear path. But by evening we somehow found our way back into the course usually followed by emigrants, not knowing whether the recent detour had lessened or increased the miles of travel, but delighted with the comfort and diversion afforded by the side ride, thinking that others seeing our tracks might be led into similar difficulties, and be less fortunate perhaps in overcoming them. Two of our young men rode back to the place of divergence and erected a notice to all comers, advising them to keep to the right. Another freak of nature, in which we were much interested, was the Devil's Gate, or Independence Rock, where we first came to the Sweetwater River in Wyoming. This is a granite ridge, some 200 feet in length, irregular in formation and height, resembling a huge molehill, extending down from the Rocky Mountain heights and being across the river's course, the gate being a vertical section, the width of the stream cut out of a spur of Rattlesnake Mountain. If His Satanic Majesty, whose name it bears, had charge of the construction, apparently he intended it only as a passageway for the river, the cut being the exact width of the river as it flows through. The greater part of the two walls stand 250 feet high, above the river level, perpendicular to the earth's plane, facing each other, the river between them at the base. Many names had been cut in the surface of the rock by passing immigrants. We stopped for half a day to view this extraordinary scene. Some of the boys went to the apex to see if the downward view made the rock walls appear as high as did the upward view, and naturally they found the distance viewed downward seemed much greater. Our intention was to stand on the brink and experience the sensation of looking down from that great height at the river. The face of the wall, where it terminates at the top, forms an almost square corner, as if hewn stone. A few bushes grew a short distance from the edge, and as we approached the brink there was a sense of greater safety in holding on to these bushes. But while holding on, we could not quite see over to the water below. We formed a chain of three persons by joining hands, one grasping a large bush, that the outer man might look over the edge if he would. But he felt shaky. He was not quite sure that the bush would not pull up by the roots, or one of the other fellows let go. For some time no one was willing to make a real effort to look over the edge, but finally Jack said he would save the party's reputation for bravery by assuming the role of the end man. He made several bold approaches toward the edge, but each time recoiled and soon admitted defeat. "Boys," said he, "I'm dizzy. I know that distance lends enchantment. I'll get back farther, take the best view I can get, and preserve the enchantment." To cover his discomfiture, he started for camp whistling, "Uli Ili Alui." The next excursion off the route in search of novelty was on a clear afternoon, a few days after passing the Devil's Gate, when three young fellows decided to take a tramp to the rock ridge lying to our right. We hoped to find some mountain sheep. From the Sweetwater River to the ridge was apparently half a mile across a grassy flat. We knew that the rare atmosphere of that high altitude often made distances deceiving, and determined to make due allowances. Having crossed the river and being ready for a sprint, each made a guess of the distance to the foot of the rock ridge. The estimates varied from about 200 yards to 300. Off we went counting paces. At the end of 300, we appeared to be no nearer the goal than when we started. The guesses were repeated, and when we were about completing the second course of stepping, making nearly 600 yards in all, one of the boys espied a mountain sheep on the top of the ridge, keeping lookout, probably, for the benefit of his fellows, feeding on the other side, as is the habit of these wary creatures. with head and great horns clearly outlined on the background of blue sky. He was a tempting target. Without a word, the three of us leveled guns and fired. Mr. Mountain Sheep stood perfectly still, looking down at us. We could not see so much as the winking of an eye. Making ready for another volley, we thought best to get nearer, but as we started, the head and horns and sheep disappeared behind the top of the ridge. Further stepping proved that we had shot at the animal from a distance of at least half a mile. Our guns were good for a range of 200 yards at most. Most of the time, especially while in the higher mountains, we were in possession of little knowledge of our position. There were no marks that we observed to indicate geographical divisions, and we had no means for determining many exact locations. Though some important rivers and prominent mountain peaks and ridges were identified, we knew little, if anything, then, of territorial boundaries, and thought of the country traversed as being so remote from the centers of civilization, at that time but little explored even, that we could not conceive any object in attempting to determine our location with reference to geographical lines, nor could we have done so except on rare occasions. Our chief concern was to know that we were on the best route to California. We crossed the summit of the Rocky Mountains by the South Pass. Though it was July, the jagged peaks of the Wind River Mountains bore a thick blanket of snow. Sometime after leaving the Devil's Gate, we passed Pacific Springs. There we gained first knowledge that we had passed the summit on observing that the streams flowed westerly. Patient plodding had now taken us a distance of actual travel amounting to much more than 1,000 miles, and from time to time into very high altitudes. About 4 miles west of Pacific Springs, we passed the junction of the California and Oregon trails at the big bend of the Bear River. Green River, where we first came to it, was in a level bit of country. There the stream was about 60 yards wide, the water clear and deep, flowing in a gentle current. For the accommodation of emigrants, 3 men were there operating a ferry. Whence they came, I do not remember if they told us. We saw no signs of habitation in which they might have lived. The ferrying was done with what was really a raft of logs, rather than a boat. It was sustained against the current by means of a tackle attached to a block, rove on a large rope that was drawn taut from bank to bank, and was propelled by a windlass on each bank. When a wagon had been taken aboard this cable ferry, the windlass on the farther side was turned by one of the men, drawing the raft across. After unloading, the raft was drawn back by operation of the windlass on the opposite shore, where it took on another load. The third man acted as conductor, collecting a toll of $3 per wagon. All the horses, mules, and cattle were driven into the river and swam across. The company passed along the shore of the Green River, down the Big Sandy River and Slate Creek, over Bear River Divide, then southwestward into Utah Territory. Join me next time for more Western adventure in Crossing the Plains, Days of 57 by William Audley Maxwell, here on the Sagebrush Trail.